people. And there is a beginning of a virtual community developing between Palestinians wherever they are, even if they don't have the physical opportunity to meet. And I read some of this correspondence. And there is, it's very naive sometimes, very utopian, very idealist. There's something there. I can see the grains of something very different.
That's Ilan Pappe, interviewed on the show out of Berkeley, KPFA, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. But he's actually speaking from Haifa. He teaches at Exeter. Surprisingly enough, the Wikipedia entry on him that has no contested items. It's spelled I-L-A-N-P-A-P-P-E, accent aigu in French, they say. Thanks for listening, and opinions again are those of the speakers. Here's just a moment, a brief moment of the group Banda Neon, who are playing behind the malanga. This is a tune called Café Dominguez, which means Café Sunday. I guess it's a Sunday Café. It's in the Boca, I guess, and they're playing at the Landmark tonight in downtown Urbana, actually, for a dance. Not quite this formation of people, but centered on the bandoneon with Joe Groans. Just a little sample. And support live local music, support Weft. And a rousing interview coming up, it seems, on the Labor Hour.
Bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. Folks, welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to affect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour and the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we got some very special guests in the studios that we'll get to here shortly. But first, we're going to read some labor news. And I guess we'll start first with you, Bob.
All right. This happened this week. The labor movement hasn't been the best in 2014 so far, with the defeat at the UAW and its attempts to organize auto workers in the South and an ominous Supreme Court ruling for public sector unions. But this week, the American Postal Workers Union and its allies seem to be making progress in an important battle. The APWU has long opposed a trial program which began in the fall of 2013 to offer postal services at staple stores. The program, the union said, would undermine the role of post offices and shift postal worker jobs to lower paid and less experienced Staples retail staff. In April, it called on other unions to join in boycotting Staples in protest of the program. And on Monday, days after the 1.6 million member American Federation of Teachers said it would join the boycott, Staples and the U.S. Postal Service told folks that the pilot program would be discontinued. The 82 Staples outlets offering postal services will shift to a more established post office-approved shipper program already available in thousands of retail outlets across the country. So interesting stuff there, that a little bit of protests and union pressure have caused Staples to back off from shifting those jobs out of post offices.
Well, it's interesting because I have the same topic, but this one is says that the company said that it would discontinue the pilot program in the coming weeks and instead would become a quote-unquote approved shipper for the United States Postal Service. But the American Postal Workers Union called the Staples move a ruse. In a statement from its president, Mark Diamondstein, stating this attempt at trickery shows the Don't Buy Staples move is having an effect. And he went on to say that the Postal Service looked forward to continuing the partnership, blah, blah, blah. The union said it would keep up the pressure and, you know, basically keep up the pressure until the whole thing is canceled with Staples. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, maybe a move in the right direction.
Yes. You know. Okay, the national organization Healthcare Now, a single-payer Medicare for All national organization, is excited to post a draft agenda for their huge strategy conference coming up in Oakland, California on the weekend of August 22nd, 24th. The conference will bring together three national single-payer networks, Healthcare Now, the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer, and One-Payer States, creating a unique opportunity this year for health care justice activists. And there's less than 3 weeks to book any hotels or everything. And then you can find out more by going to the Healthcare Now website to find out more about that. And I really wish I could go to that. But unfortunately, August 21st is my wife's birthday, and I can't be out of town for that. So I get in a lot of trouble.
A couple of strikes were averted this week. Truckers in Los Angeles were back on the job on Monday in Los Angeles and Long Beach, ending a five-day strike that disrupted cargo flow. Truckers voted to end their work stoppage against three companies late Friday after the firms promised no retaliation, and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti asked for a cooling-off period. Following the city's meetings with both sides, the Teamsters have agreed to pull down their pickets and enter a cooling-off period to allow the Harbor Commission time to investigate the serious allegations regarding worker safety, poor working conditions, and unfair labor practices. So the drivers had walked off the job last Monday in the fourth such protest this year, and dock workers had refused to cross picket lines last Tuesday until an arbitrator ordered them back to work. Also, a strike by the New York commuter rails had been averted. This was after 4 years of negotiations and weeks of fretting by 300,000 daily riders about a possible strike. Unions and management at the nation's largest commuter railroad reached a tentative contract agreement Thursday. Once again, the deal announced by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who personally got involved in the final hours of the negotiations, gives Long Island Railroad workers a 17% pay raise over 6.5 years, but requires them to contribute to their health care costs for the first time. So a couple strikes kind of averted this week or recently.
Okay. Water is a basic human right, and that was the strong message sent to Detroit Works Detroit Future Project during the environmental session held as part of their community conversations. These conversations are orchestrated conversations that the group Detroit Future claims gives it legitimacy to reshape the city of Detroit. And the failure of Detroit Future, the Bright Elimination Task Force, or any elected officials to demand a moratorium on water shutoffs reveals their complicity in the effort to remove people from their homes. They do not challenge the takeover of Detroit cities by corporate powers. And let's be clear, these water shutoffs are not about unpaid bills. This is about dispossession of people. These shutoffs are intended to drive people from their homes, and water is the wedge. And people are being targeted at the rate of 1,500 to 3,000 homes a week. And one of the ways we know this is not about unpaid bills is the glaring contradiction between the treatment of homeowners and corporate clients. Under its governor-appointed emergency manager, who basically circumvents the entire city government of Detroit, they show outstanding bills, but of the outstanding bills, Palmer Park Golf Club owes $200,000, Joe Louis Arena Red Wings Hockey owes $80,000, and Ford Field owes $55,000. The struggling city of Highland Park, also under emergency management, owes $17.4 million, and none of these have been threatened with shutoff. Most likely, the water shutoffs would have happened quietly, except that aggressive action was required to convince suburban powers and private speculators that the Detroit water system is a viable asset for privatization. Viability in this case required making a public show of shutoffs, and this aggressive action is a source of money making for yet another corporation. And anyway, the response on the part of the people has been swift. Community meetings have sprung up all over at homes, churches, and small businesses as they face shutoff, and people are teaching each other how to turn water back on. Some people are parking cars over shutoff valves, and environmental activist Charity Hicks was arrested for having the audacity to ask that people be allowed to fill up water jugs before the turnoff at a public meeting. International water rights activist Maud Barlow was in town and is making a human rights charge against the city of the United Nations. Clergy nationally are laying support to this effort, and also there's been groups of Canadians that have been crossing the border with water for people. These water shutoffs are coming on the heels of a less publicized but equally inhumane series of shutoffs of heat and light between January and September of 2013. So we see shock doctrine at work here, and we're going to be trying to get I'm working on getting somebody from Detroit to call on the show here sometime in August, hopefully, so we'll have more on that. But of course, the way the corporate media is presenting this is that these people that are getting their water shut off are just, you know, welfare cheats who want to spend money on cable and satellite TV and other luxuries instead of paying their bills. So,
yeah. hypocritical when those companies you're talking about that own Ford Field and Joe Louis Arena owe over $100,000,
yes,
and they're not turning their water off,
exactly,
and stuff like that.
Exactly. So. Okay, we're going to take a short music break, then we're going to be right back with our special guests in the studio. You're listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Okay, that was Chumbawamba, and we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois, and three very special guests here. Welcome to the World Labor Hour, and I'd like you to all introduce yourself just real briefly.
My name is Rachel Storm. I'm the Assistant Director of the Women's Resources Center at the University of Illinois. I also serve as the Program Director of the Board of the Independent Media Center in Urbana.
Okay.
My name is Carol Huang. I'm a professor at City College of New York and also a research director for Asian American and Asian Research Institute of CUNY.
Okay.
And I'm almost plus sabbatical, so that's what I'm in Urbana.
Okay.
My name is Susan Parenti. I'm a composer and playwright, and I teach at the School for Designing a Society here in Urbana.
Okay, so you're all here today because of this really interesting, exciting film festival, the Interdependent Film Festival. So let's start with Rachel. Can you explain a little bit about the film festival, why, you know, all the things, you know, why and, you know, how and all that sort of thing?
Certainly. The Interdependent Film Festival is dubbed this year Women Make Movies. It's its inaugural year, so this is the first annual, and we hope it to be an annual reoccurrence in Champaign-Urbana. We're looking at it taking place right now on July 31st to August 2nd. So it'll be 3 days of numerous films, all made by women filmmakers who all have a relationship in some form or another to Champaign-Urbana. A lot of the films were made here in Champaign-Urbana, and you'll see a lot of familiar places voices and people. So it'll be an exciting lineup. One of the things about each night that we're sponsoring a film is that we're actually going to be showing a short film as well as a feature film each evening, to be followed by community dialogues and discussions with various folks from Champaign-Urbana who have relationships to the film's topics and ideas. And we'll also be featuring a workshop that really is aimed at helping develop grassroots filmmaking in Champaign-Urbana. So one of the things that we hope folks take away from the Interdependent Film Festival is the idea that filmmaking is accessible, that people in Champaign-Urbana can pick topics here from our local community and highlight them through filmmaking. So we'll be actually helping to educate folks in skill shares and workshops as well, in particular a two-hour one on Saturday, August 2nd, from 4 to 6 p.m., where we'll be really working with local people who are interested in making films and connecting them with different resources in the community, technological knowledge, all kinds of different things about how to go about it. So those are some things that we're really looking forward to. The film festival itself is sponsored by the School for Designing a Society and the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. It's pretty affordable. Our tickets are $25 for an early bird ticket, $35 at the door, and that's for the entire festival, so that's a festival pass. If you can't make it to everyone and you want to just come to a couple nights or one night, they are $15 per show or $7 low income. No one will be turned away for lack of funds, so we want to make sure that we underscore that. We want this festival to be open to everyone in the community. And tickets can also be purchased in advance online through brown bag ticketing, so that's something that we've been able to set up and we're really excited about. The films themselves explore everything from gentrification, immigration, healthcare, poverty, ecofeminism, lots of different critiques of ways in which we're trying to build a better future together. So a lot of the filmmaking is visionary. It's exciting. Some of it's experimental. Some of it's documentary. Some of it's a mix of both. And it's featuring works by Sarah Knaus, Susan Parenti, Nina Paley, Carol Huang, Roberta Bennett, Catherine Murphy, Meadow Jones, and Kate DeCiccio. So okay. We're really excited about all of that.
Could you explain ecofeminism? That's sort of a new one to me, a new category.
Well, ironically, I actually coordinate the Campus Ecofeminism Summit every year. But what it seeks to do is kind of take some of the tenets that we look at when we think about power and labor and how labor itself is gendered and how power is so gendered, and we apply that to how we think about the environment. A very famous ecofeminist is, there's a lot of different kinds of ideas around ecofeminism, but when we've had our campus ecofeminist project, we've usually had folks talking about linkages between women's rights and the environmental rights. We'll look at social justice, so things like environmental racisms. We'll look at local issues, like, for instance, the Fifth and Hill contamination in Champaign, labor and environmental problems that happened over at Flexengate. Some of these different things have been topics of conversation in the past at that festival, so it's been really an opportunity to talk more about that. But that's just one of the topics, and one of the films that we're featuring is the Monsanto hearings, as well as a film called No Place to Put It. No Place to Put It looks at kind of contamination, and it has a lot of people talking who had done a lot of labor around contaminated land about how it affected their health, their bodies, their families, and how they didn't know about it at the time. So there's some really interesting, you know, linkages that we can make between a lot of these issues as well.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. Okay. Yes, of course, seems like the environmental issue is, well, it affects everybody, let's face it, but it seems like more and more as time goes on here that there's a environmental labor connection. Not to say there never was, you know, it's just it's becoming more, I think, more people are becoming aware of it, I guess. So, okay, let's go to Carol. Carol,
yes.
Now you have a film at this festival, and I understand you've been working on this film for 10 years?
Yes.
Okay, could you talk a little about the film?
The film started in 1999.
Uh-huh.
Yes, with Maria Silva, who is
a
fieldwork manager. Mm-hmm. And I think she contributed a lot to the film.
Okay.
We pretty much interested in a group of migrant worker from Mexico, and then it was started the project by them agreeing to let us film their daily life. So the project actually lasts 10 years. We spent a lot of weekends just filming them and then interview them. Through the process, we went to Mexico twice to visit their hometown. So this is a group of peasants from a very small village of about 1,000 people from Chiapas.
Okay.
And how they settle in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
That was a curiosity I have.
Mm-hmm.
And also how they form and then settle into Midwest. Even though migrant workers have very long history in Illinois as the Wetback, you know, in the beginning, and then, you know, pick detasseling and later on. But now this group, because the agricultural work in the summer pretty much dwindled down with the genetic engineering, with all the corn that no longer need detasseling except seed corns. So the work they have done in the past is just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And now they pretty much want to settle and also work in the factory. But they so this particular town we featured in that the group of our subjects came is a town that, like a lot of Midwest towns, suffer a lot through the loss of its main industry and main employer. So they came to fill in the gap, to fill in the workers' gap, because a lot of people left. So they work in much lower wages,
mm-hmm.
They much longer hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you say the people left, I mean,
yes.
Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, why did they leave?
They left, for instance, we were in Hoopston,
mm-hmm.
and in 2003, I think,
mm-hmm.
or 2003, they have a touchdown of they call strong wind, because they don't want to call it tornado,
mm-hmm.
Because of compensation issues, that went through the factory and canning factory,
mm-hmm.
And then put the roof right into his parking lot. And
mm-hmm.
destroy almost millions of cans
mm-hmm.
that lay outside. So all the cans, wind just blow through it, and then the factory shut down.
Okay.
So Hoopston suffered a lot. Traditionally, Hoopston was the major site.
So the factory shut down for quite a long period of time then?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
And that was last straw
of
the town, I think.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when these new workers were hired, you said they were hired at less wages than the previous workers?
Yes, because mm-hmm. They pretty much work for my observation and then interviews, majority of them earn about $250, you know, take home every week. So they have less than $1,000
mm-hmm.
for a family, maybe two or three.
Mm-hmm.
So it's impossible to survive in the Midwest with, you know, they have to afford a car in order to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
So with that kind of structure, they have to have other people. So it's like a coexistence with their campesinos,
mm-hmm.
Their relatives or friends from Mexico.
Okay. The reason I ask, because being a lifelong resident here in Champaign, and actually
yes.
Having some people in the past who I was friends with in Hoopston, you know, that's a large, Hoopston has always had, I mean, I don't know how far back, I mean, gosh, I mean, probably before the 1960s even, there was always a large, primarily Mexican, but you can say in general Latino population in Hoopston who worked in these canning factories and made decent money. I mean, they actually had somewhat middle class incomes. And I find this interesting that they used the destruction of the factory to hire in new workers at obviously a lot less wages than the previous workers were being hired. So this has got a lot of different interesting aspects to it, you know, which is a familiar story, unfortunately.
Yeah, so unfortunately, all these agricultural based towns that suffer through the past two decades. When I was teaching in Southern Illinois, my graduate student came to report that each year the poverty rate, free lunch rate of their school increased by 5%. So within one decade, you know, it's like a lot of people depend on school to feed the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a Midwestern town in southern southern Illinois. Mm-hmm. Houston, I think, also suffer a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the real estate price of the, you know, gorgeous house selling for less than $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know the town have trouble.
Yes, indeed, indeed. I think it's interesting, too, that these workers that you documented were from Chiapas, which I don't know how many of the listeners out there are aware of what's, you know, the political, I guess you'd say, problems in Chiapas going back, 15 years or more, with the Zapatista uprising, and which, from what I understand, there's been a truce for many years, but there's still sort of a standoff between the people in Chiapas who are in the certain areas that are controlled by them and having problems, confrontations with the Mexican military all the time. So I guess what I'm getting at here, it sounds like, you know, again, another familiar story, policies, neoliberal policies, pushed by the United States government with our tax money, causes disruptions in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, which then causes people to flee sometimes for their lives or for dire economic situations to come here and be exploited and in effect hurting not just them but everybody that's living here too. So it's I think this is what's really interesting about your film, that you're documenting this sort of kind of that it is happening right here in central Illinois.
Yeah, I think in Chiapas, this group of people actually was impacted by free trade.
Mm-hmm.
And then free trade, WHO very much want to make the economic system transparent in order to join the world system.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the opportunity to buy the communal land. Because the communal land has to be divided,
mm-hmm.
and people have the opportunity. They are subsistence farmers,
mm-hmm.
But they also want more land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they left their hometown around free trade,
mm-hmm.
And then went to the border.
Mm-hmm.
They work at the border and know learn soon that they cannot make ends meet,
mm-hmm.
in the maquiladora,
mm-hmm.
factory, and then soon they learn to cross. So they cross from into California, but the time was just anti-Latino,
mm-hmm.
Mexican,
mm-hmm.
sentiment, which is very, very difficult for them to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
So they gradually migrate and then came to Chicago. And
mm-hmm.
from Chicago, they also have trouble because, you know, they are behind. They are very late. They came. There are a lot of well-established community. So gradually they found their niche in the Midwest town that is suffering also,
mm-hmm.
looking for a new group of people when the town, older community left. And so therefore they came in and gradually work, get the niche in small factories.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm interested in them is that how this free trade policy pushed them out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're from Chiapas, pretty much the last group. They're very close to the Guatemala border, about 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
From Guatemala border. So they also is a kind of a midway station for South American cross. So they are very well and not aware of all these difficulties in
mm-hmm.
Guatemala, Honduras, because they receive all these people, they work in their land crossing. And then they used to be, you know, very proud landlord.
Mm-hmm.
But once they came to the United States and also experienced the same experience that those crossing their land have experienced in the southern Mexico border, they become more compassionate mm-hmm. to those people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really, I like that angle. That's good.
Yeah,
and of course, the southern people living in Chiapas area are mostly of Mayan descent.
Yes.
Okay, like the Guatemalans and some of the Hondurans. So really, Spanish is their second language. And so English is a third language, more or less.
I think you also have to look at Mexico policy.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all the indigenous traces are all, you know, eliminated through the process of education, socialization.
Oh, okay.
So they do not think they're indigenous, even though they look very indigenous.
Okay, okay.
So we try to push, as I'm interested in, you know, what their identity, but they, when I asked them about the Zapatistas, where they were here when that thing, the insurgent happened, they're very compassionate to those people. They said, well, everybody should not, should have land to farm, and then people should not be driven out from their land.
And what's the title of the film again?
The title is Free Trade Refugees from Chiapas to the Prairie.
Free Trade Refugees from Chiapas to the Prairies.
It is on August 2nd, 7 o'clock at IMC.
Okay. Saturday. Yeah. All right, Susan, so you're going to talk a little about some various topics on the film festival, and also you have a movie, too, we want to talk about here some way, work it in.
Right. Yes, I wanted to talk about a few things, kind of the politics of what we're doing. First, I guess I'll start with my own personal politics. I had been noticing that a lot of people I respected, women, were working very hard on things, either plays or music or films. In Carol and Maria Silva's case, Catherine Murphy, who has a film on the Literacy Project, was also working on that for 10 years. I worked on something, my film. I thought it was going to take a month. It took practically 2 years. And that we were putting a huge amount of effort and care, coordinating with lots of people, which is why we call it the Interdependent Film Festival, because independent means you just go off and do your thing, but interdependent means, and it's a feminist idea, that you include all sorts of people because you don't want to have a big budget and a Hollywood mentality. You have your friends as actors, your mother holds the camera. I mean, not quite that bad. But I first was thinking that this year, I was just noticing that many people do great things, and the buildup to produce it is huge, and then it seems to go nowhere. So you don't see it spread around town. And it's not that you want to be talking about someone becoming popular. What you see is a lot of work done by people for a message they think is crucial for society. It's not funded. You don't have somebody saying, this is the popular thing, we have to have people being beheaded this year. Whether these people, especially these women, really decided that this was a needed message. And they'd work to not, in a sense, compete with the commercial industry, because we can't, but to make imagination and distinctness and the importance of the message be stronger than all the visual technology that Hollywood can produce. Okay, and then it just sits there. So I was one such person. I made this film and it just sat there. I mean, it sits there in the sense of you buy 100 copies and you give away 20 to your relatives.
I have one.
For Christmas, you start giving them and you know you're in trouble. So I thought, not to say I was such a goody-two-shoes person, but I thought, instead of just pushing my own film, why don't I have a festival which pushes all our films? And even further, we hope that maybe next year we'll have 30 films and it'll be a week-long thing. So that came from a kind of an idea of trying to include, a socialist idea, include the well-being as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Also, let me talk about film itself. Film, in my sense, because I'm really trained as an experimental music composer, but film as a medium is winning over all other artistic mediums. Poetry, not doing well. Book writing, not well. Playwrights, who goes to plays. Music, maybe is doing well, but film, the production, the amount of films that people see and do is enormous. It's enormous corporate industry, and it's one of the biggest public media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you make a film and you don't know who sees it, so you're interfacing with a lot of strangers, and it has a huge amount of power. It's the only medium where we sit and watch this FBI warning telling us that if we play this film, we'll be put in prison. I sit there and I fume. I mean, I go to music concerts. Have you ever been in a music concert where for the first 2 minutes it tells you if you play this music, you will be given a fine of $250,000 and also sent to 5 years in prison? I mean, that we accept this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone knows when you have an art form, yes, you want to be supported a little bit, but you want it to spread. You want people to recite your poetry, etc. So a little bit this idea of trying to make this festival be an inspiration and a support for people feeling in town here that they could make films. And we're going to try to get a great, great big whiteboard. I don't know if we can do it. So that in the midst of discussion, someone might jump up and write on the whiteboard, we need to see this. Somebody needs to make this idea. Or as a woman, we need to show this. Or as someone in Champaign, or as a worker, or as a laborer, so that we would be commissioning each other to go ahead and try this. In both Carol's film, Free Trade Refugees, and in mine, Healthcare in All the Wrong Places, we had a huge helper, a person, a man in town here, Bogdan Heratui, who, in Carol's case, she had a huge amount of footage.
Yes.
Huge. That Bogdan did the editing for.
150 hours.
Yes. Oh, wow. Wow.
And he was so clear in his vision that he wanted to make these working people, the Mexicans, really sympathetic to the audience. You really love these people, and you see what happens to them. In my case, he was working with a playwright who had never done a movie before, who, again, I repeat, I thought it was going to take 4 weeks to film. And he took what was basically a play. I wrote 13 scenes trying to show that people who can't get health care in the right places, what happens, and they're sick, what happens when they go to the wrong places, when they go to a manicure parlor. And it was really not necessarily to talk about health care so much as talk about capacities of language as they meet one another. So someone with an illness narrative, so to speak, goes into a bank, and the banker can only talk bank speak, and the illness person can only talk ill speak, and you see how they don't fit. And I was really trying to do this because the 14th scene, the scene I couldn't write, is the one about the corporate healthcare system. The fact that illness is used as a profit transaction is, for me, such a devastation. And I was trying to point out that if illness in the corporate system is used as a profit transaction, then maybe we get better health care by going to a manicurist,
yes,
by having the postal worker. Maybe those worlds of language and concepts work better. So this is what Bogdan had to work with. Someone like me, who trained in music, I really don't care about lighting and what anybody looks like. And he had to basically teach me or just go override me. So it was really good. He's a real asset in the community, Bogdan Heratui, so I wanted to talk about him a bit.
I have a limited experience with film editing. You're talking about all those. How many hours did you have? 150?
150 hours.
Okay, and it got distilled. The final version is how long?
I cut it to 4 hours and 10 minutes.
But that's not the final version.
And then Bogdan cut it to 71 minutes.
A little over an hour and a half. Well, just from my experience having a television program and editing documentaries, and the real problem is the better made the film, the more difficult it is to edit the film down to a certain time period. So I can sort of relate to this, how much work that would require, how many and the tough decisions to make as you get closer and closer and closer down.
And working with him long distance.
Yes. Oh, you're doing it long distance. Oh.
So a lot of technical glitches to overcome, and he have done that wonderfully. Yes.
Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, but we will be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour, and this is Party Community Radio Station in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Down. 3 days in the water, watching all to the wars to be slain, to be slain. And they sent him to the wars to be slain. On this Jacob's ladder.
Okay, we're back. Again, that was Chumbawamba, Jacob's Ladder, and we're back here with our special guests talking about the upcoming Interdependent Film Festival. And so, Rachel, wow, I can't believe how fast the time flew here talking about this. This is just an incredible idea, I mean, in and of itself, but the whole thing about having a whiteboard and inspiring people to do films for next time is just, it's pure genius, in my opinion. So, anyway, go ahead and what would you like to talk about next about this?
I'd like to give us a rundown kind of what films you're going to see between July 31st and August 2nd. So I'm going to go through everything, and all of these are going to be taking place at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, which is at 202 South Broadway in Urbana. The UCIMC, as we know it, is home to a lot of different projects. Its mission is art, media, and activism for social change. One of the things that the IMC has been able to do is be a hub for a lot of independent and grassroots media making. So we have a really awesome lineup of films. Everything takes place at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. And we start on July 31st at 7 p.m. In terms of films. But I should mention that we have an extra special gala event happening beforehand from 6 to 7 p.m. So that's a film festival opening gala. The entire community is invited. There'll be food. There'll be music. So please come out and check that out. But on July 31st at 7, we're going to be starting off with a film by Roberta Bennett, No Place to Put It. Roberta is an artist and a local person as well. No Place to Put It, I mentioned earlier, is an environmental activist film. That is a short film that will be followed by the Monsanto hearings, a feature film by Sarah Knaus, exploring similar themes. On August 1st, we'll be showing a short film by Catherine Murphy called Maestra. And this actually explores a literacy project that took place in 1961 in Cuba that was run by thousands upon thousands of volunteers, many of whom were women, and how in 1 year's time literacy improved to an extreme extent in Cuba. And so this really looks at that project, in particular how this project was really women-run as well. So that film is Maestra. That's taking place 7 p.m. on August 1st, which is Friday. Healthcare in All the Wrong Places by Susan Prenti was mentioned earlier in the segment today. That's another film that's going to be shown. That's our feature film for that evening. It looks at metaphor in healthcare. On August 2nd, we're going to be showing short films by Meadow Jones. Meadow Jones is a doctoral student in art education. She has her master's in Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois. Her films have really been around in a lot of different places. In particular, her films have been featured in the Champaign-Urbana Feminist Film Festival, where she took away 3 awards in one evening at one point for a film called Emergence that looked at gender and subversion. She also has had her films showcased at Rhino Fest at the Prop Theater in Chicago and art exhibits here locally. And she herself has curated a number of film and art exhibitions in the area. So we're really excited about showcasing her films as well. That night, the feature film will be Sita Sings the Blues by our very own Nina Paley. She comes from Champaign-Urbana. Nina Paley is a free culture activist. She's also known as trying to create a movement of copy left instead of copyright. And the idea behind all of that is that Nina's actually waived all copyright and neighboring rights to the films that she's made, especially Sita Sings the Blues. And one of the things about that film is it's looking at a sort of feminist rewriting of a traditional Hindu folktale. So that's a really interesting piece as well, and we're excited to be showing that. And then Saturday is August 2nd, so there's 2 films this day, and it's actually quite a long day. So we actually start at 2 p.m. with the ones I just mentioned. Then we have from 4 to 6 p.m. that kind of grassroots filmmaking workshop I mentioned earlier, where that will have actually a lot of our filmmakers will be there. They'll be giving a panel discussion on the creation and process making of their films, and followed by a kind of hands-on small group breakouts where we'll be actually workshopping some ideas for new films. So that'll be really exciting if anyone out there is thinking about making a film. That's something you should come out for. And then later that evening, we'll be showing short films by Kate DeCicio. Kate DeCicio is a street artist, educator, mental health specialist from West Oakland. She's taught art and street graffiti to youth, and also looked at how to kind of create art as a healing practice. So she's even taught art in the context of incarceration and classrooms that are in prisons, as well as prisons for the criminally insane. So she's had some really interesting experiences with how to merge sort of art and activism. Her films kind of explore some of the projects that she's done. And then in the evening, following that, is Free Trade Refugees, mentioned earlier by Carol Huang, exploring immigration and labor. So we're really excited to see all of these films. Again, festival passes can be purchased online at brownbagtickets.com, but they can also be purchased at the door. And I'll just run down those pricings one more time. $25 for an early bird ticket, $35 at the door for the entire festival. Per show, we're looking at $15 or $7 low income. No one will be turned away for lack of funds, and the entire festival takes place at the UCIMC Independent Media Center and is sponsored by the School for Designing a Society and the Champaign-Urbana Independent Media Center. So we're really excited to see all this here.
Okay, that was a lot of information. Mm-hmm. Is there a website or a Facebook page
Yes.
someone can go to?
Yes. So both of both the School for Designing a Society's front page, as well as the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center's front page, have information right there when you go to the website right now about the film festival. I'm a huge user of Facebook, so anybody else who does, we do have a Facebook event page with a lot of details as well as linkages to get tickets and things. So,
okay, well, thank you so much for coming in. This has been just really fascinating. And any last words from anybody? We still got a little time here, but we are approaching the 12 noon hour.
Make films. We really believe that anybody can make a film. Each of us around the table have made films before, and we're really excited to showcase films and help people connect themselves to resources.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Carol and Rachel and Susan, for coming in. You really honored us with our presence today, letting you know, the listeners know about this very important project. And I look forward to seeing you know, many years of this happening again and again. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Okay, another song by Chumbawamba, doing a little Chumbawamba theme today on the music. Anyway, some public service announcements. The None Other Sports Show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen is this Saturday and every Saturday from 2 to 3 on 104.5 FM WRFU. And you can also catch it on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television, and also at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. And on Sunday, this Sunday and every Sunday is Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. Also on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television, or at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. And on Labor's Worldview this Sunday and throughout most of the summer up until about the middle of August, we're showing oldies but goodies, which are old documentary films from like the 1930s auto workers sit-down and occupation strikes, also the longshoremen workers and general strike in San Francisco in the 1930s, and a whole bunch of historical stuff that we've done on past shows. But coming up in the middle of August, we're going to have two films about commemorating the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which will be 9 years this coming August, and we're also going to, of course, be having a special on that here on the World Labor Hour. And last but not least, we're also going to be having a special two-hour Labor Day program on Saturday, August 30th, which is, basically our Labor Day program. So anyway, Bob, you had an interesting story that I just thought the listeners need to hear before we sign off, or actually, sign off and go over to Union Edge.
Yeah. We talked before about child labor in China and stuff like that, and I think I focused mainly on Apple and some of those companies, but Apple's not the only one. Samsung Electronics Corporation said this week that it halted business with a supplier in China over suspected use of child workers, the first time it's taken such a step, after criticism that its monitoring of labor practices at suppliers was inadequate. So this decision came down on Monday. Comes with less than a week after U.S.-based China Labor Watch said it found at least five child workers without contracts at the supplier and called Samsung's monitoring process to halt such practices ineffective. So Samsung said it conducted three audits since 2013 of the supplier, a subsidiary of Xinyang Engineering, and the latest of which ended June 25th. But the investigation by China Labor Watch said that Samsung's investigations were weak, to say the least, and they did find abuses going on there. So this story persists in China of child labor and contract workers and stuff like that. So
yeah, and it's other places besides China too, and sure, Asia,
and it's almost all of those manufacturers over there that are abusing the workers like that. Like I say, it's not just Apple or Samsung and HP and Dell, and every one of these high tech companies seems to take advantage of the workers in these places.
Yeah, and child labor is just the absolute worst. I mean, that issue was dealt with almost 100 years ago in this country finally ended. But now the descendants of the same people that profited and exploited child labor in 100 years ago or now have revived it in other parts of the world.
Exactly.
So remember that when you go to Walmart. Think about that. Yeah. Think about that low price. Not just what it does to affect workers here who are having to get food stamps and Medicaid and other types of government assistance basically supplied by taxpayers in order to subsidize a multi-billion dollar corporation, and the same corporation and others like them not just exploit workers here to enforce the taxpayers to basically subsidize them for their low wages to workers here.